reconvene the hearings.
Yes, good morning, Commissioners. I'm appearing for the submitters in this hearing. Just before I start on my legal submissions, I have handed up zone provisions for the Coneburn Industrial Zone. Those will be formally introduced, if you like, through Ms. Hutton's summary statement, but I do refer to them in my opening, so I thought it would be handy for you to have those before you. Also included A3 versions of the structure plan for the zone and the height limit structure plan that is referred to in the rules.
Just before we proceed, there's three documents. Can we give them exhibit numbers, maybe whatever the number is, and then A, B, C?
Yeah. Yes, there's the subdivision amendments in there as well to the subdivision chapter.
Yes. So we'll call the industrials the chapter 18 one.
Yeah, we're up to 13.20.
So we'll go 13.2 from A for the industrial zone proposal. B for the chapter 27 changes, and C for the A3 plans.
Thank you, sir. These submissions are presented on behalf of a number of landowners. I've set them out in my paragraph 1. I won't repeat them. I refer to them collectively as the submitter. The submitter owns various parcels of land which together comprise the proposed Coneburn Industrial Zone. And I've attached to my submissions a couple of maps showing, first of all, the land ownership across the zones, or the zone rather, and the second plan just shows the zone boundaries overlaid over that land ownership plan, and the different colours represent the different land ownerships there. The focus of the evidence and submissions for this hearing stream is the proposed Coneburn Industrial Zone. The zone is proposed for land located in the vicinity of the remarkable ski field access road along the eastern side of State Highway 6. The location and physical attributes of the land make it an ideal location for the type of industrial land use promoted in the evidence and in the zone provisions that have been proposed. The landscape values of the locality have been carefully considered in the expert analysis and evidence for the submitter. Avoiding inappropriate development and impacts on landscape values has been a key driver in the development of the zone and the identification of specific development areas. Development of the zone will take place in accordance with a structure plan. The range of industrial activities promoted benefit from the rural location of the site and its location proximate to urban areas of Frankston, Jacks Point and Henley Downs. The benefits of the zoning are significant, both from an environmental and economic perspective. Now, just turning to an overview of the zone. The purpose of the zone is to provide for industrial and service activities, and I've just noted there that both of those terms are defined in the PDP, with standalone offices, residential and almost all retail uses avoided. They're given prohibited activity status. To ensure the zone does not take on a mixed-use character, we reverse sensitivity issues and land value make industrial and some business uses unviable within the zone. It's comprised of a total of 63.24 hectares, of which 27.5 hectares is identified to provide for service and industrial activities, and 35.99 hectares as internal roading and retained open space. The zone is a standalone industrial zone with its own objective and policy framework, which is independent of the operative district plans, industrial zones and associated definitions. A wide range of industrial and service activities are enabled, including activities within the definition of trade supplier I've just again made a note there that there's a term or a definition in the PDP, and I've taken that, or we've used the council's reply version of that definition in our provisions, such as and the types of activities there under that definition are automotive and marine supplies, building supplies, catering equipment supplies, etc. Offices are permitted as ancillary activity, and food and beverage retailing limited to 50 metres square per premise is enabled. Buildings that are compliant with standards are a controlled activity. Building coverage is staggered. 30 to 40% building coverage in activity area 1A is a restricted discretionary activity, and beyond that it will be non-compliant. And from 35 to 65% in activity area 2A, restricted discretionary, and beyond that non-compliant. I'll just note here that Ms. Hudden will take you through the matters over which control is or discretion is reserved there, because that rule also has relevance in terms of Mr. Bartlett's evidence and the removal of the roundabout and reliance on two intersections and the control of traffic generation based around site coverage. The zone contains a standard to measure building height. And I've just noted there that a similar rule was proposed in the Homestead Bay area for the Jacks Points hearings based on an RL level. The building height is mapped on the height limit structure plan based on registered levels. Access onto the state highway is via two access locations with a trigger rule for the second once development within the zone exceeds 25%, no longer provision for a roundabout. Finally, additional provisions are added to the subdivision chapter for the Combin Industrial Zone, and to encourage larger lot sizes within Activity Area 1A, a minimum lot size of 3,000 square metres is proposed. Context and background. The existing consents and zoning sort reflects the current use of part of the proposed zone for industrial purposes. The genesis for this submission started out, given probably you would have perhaps appreciated the bulk of it, as a private plan change request. Ms. Hutton describes this in her evidence, but initially contact was made with the council with a view to promoting a private plan change in 2014. However, we were told to pack our bags and wait for the district plan review and submit it as part of that process, and here we are. There seems to be a bit of inconsistency in approach. There's no rationale really for stage one matters that are or aren't included. No industrial zones in stage one, yet there's provision made for rural industrial zones at Wanaka. Of course, I refer to the NPS on urban development capacity. That's relevant to this rezoning request, and the evidence is that we need more industrial land now. The submitter had no option but to put forward a comprehensive zoning submission. This is its only opportunity to do so. Specific legal issues. The submitter has no particular issue with the legal principles set out in the council's opening submissions for this hearing stream. How these principles are applied in the context of the land covered in the submission is to all intents and purposes an evidence-based exercise. To that end, I have restricted my submissions to addressing matters of law or interpretation where particular differences or issues have arisen. Just in terms of scope and staging, there's never been an issue that this submission is on stage one of the plan review, and this has been made clear from early memoranda filed by council for the council, identifying those submissions which were within scope and those not on stage one of the review. And here, Mr. Chairman, I've set out your minute, which helpfully clarified what the issue is in regards to submissions that are seeking a zone that isn't included in stage one of the review and the requirements that submitters need to satisfy. And moving on to those, in terms of the strategic chapters, Ms. Hutton addresses the giving effect to the strategic chapters through her thoroughly in her evidence. She also identifies relevant provisions of the regional planning documents relevant to the provision of industrial land. I say it's disappointing that Mr. Buxton does not acknowledge this in this analysis and his rebuttal. One assumes, because he takes no further issue with it, that this element of the rezoning request, in terms of the Chair's helpful directions, is satisfied so far as council officers are concerned. That leaves Mr. Buxton concerned at the inefficiency of the submitter rewriting the zone. That, however, is a matter for the submitter, and as I discussed below, it has been done. Nor are there any inconsistencies or gaps with definitions crossing over from the operative to the PDP. There are rather efficiencies with adopting PDP definitions such as trade supplier, which replace the long-winded list of activities found in the Industrial B activity table. Whether and to what extent the Cone-Byrne industrial provisions are revisited at some future stage of the plan review as part of a review of district-wide industrial provisions is a matter to which the submitter is alive in pursuing its Cone-Byrne industrial zoning in stage one of the plan review. One thing is, however, certain, the submitter had no choice but to be involved in stage one. It could not risk awaiting some further stage for the industrial and business zones to be reviewed. If the council chose not to revisit the extent of industrial zoned land in a future stage of the review, as opposed to just the rules, for example, or policies, the submitter would have no jurisdiction to seek rezoning of its land, and limited options other than to await the rural provisions of the plan becoming operative and then to seek a private plan change, which in itself, of course, could be rebuked given the requirement that 2 years, or otherwise, obviously, a resource consent process, which would be inefficient and undesirable in my submission for a development of this size. A solution that fits. The submitter has consistently sought an industrial zoning based on the operative industrial B zone provisions, as Ms. Hutton has opined then. That industrial B zone is a recent introduction to the operative plan, introduced to zone additional land in Wanaka for industrial purposes and addressing some of the defects in the district-wide provisions. And I note there, those were notified in 1995 and they haven't to date been revisited. The format of the industrial B zone with its separate activity and standards tables is not dissimilar to that adopted in the PDP. Ms. Hutton's evidence appended the operative plan provisions for the business and industrial zones and identified therein some specific objectives, policies and rules for the Cone-Byrne site, as did the submission that's originally lodged. Further work has been done on those provisions in the lead up to this hearing so that they are now capable of standing alone as a separate chapter of the PDP, independent of the ODP's industrial zone provisions. There have been no changes of any substance to the Cone-Byrne, but rather the zone has been refined so that it now is specific to the Cone-Byrne industrial area and includes its own set of objectives policies based on industrial B provisions, but tailored to address where appropriate the Cone-Byrne zone and specific activities contemplated within it. The provisions have been reformatted to fit with the form of the PDP. Should we wait? Initial recommendations from council staff were that rezoning the submitter's land ahead of stage two of the review is premature. The chair's minute that it is permissible to hear and determine the zoning request now appears to have put that issue to bed, at least from a process perspective. In case there is any doubt that rezoning the submitter's land should be put off to some future date, I'll just refer there to an earlier footnote with respect to the council's proposed staging of the review, and now we're up to at least another three or four stages, and indicative timelines for notification would see industrial being notified early in 2019. I'll make the following submissions. There is a need to rezone the submitter's land now to address the NPS requirements for the provision of industrial land supply. The evidence of both Mr. Copeland and Mr. Osborne supports the zoning of the land for industrial purposes. There's no suggestion in the expert evidence that rezoning should be deferred until further information has been gathered or the council conduct further research. There's ample information currently available to support the case for rezoning this land for industrial purposes. The site is one of few, if not the only one on the radar at the moment, suitable for industrial zoning. There have been many Environment Court and former Planning Tribunal cases testing the wait-and-see philosophy, particularly in the early days of first-generation plans. A favourite quote of mine from Mullen in Auckland City Council is, "It's not enough for the council to allege there may be other effects not heard of. Developers do not normally have to allow for dragons or other monsters until there is evidence they exist." There are no dragons or monsters here. You have all the information you require and could reasonably expect or anticipate to make a decision on the rezoning request. There is nothing to be gained by waiting. Just moving on now to the removal of the roundabout. First of all, the reason for its removal. Between lodgement of the submission and preparation for this hearing, the submitter has undertaken further discussions with NZTA regarding the construction of a roundabout at or about the Woolshed Road location. Quite simply, without a funding partner or partners, the construction costs for a roundabout are cost prohibitive. The submitter has therefore elected to consider other options for access onto the state highway in tandem with potential development yield. Removal of the roundabout as an access option has required the submitter to undertake further traffic modelling for the site to satisfy NZTA and ensure the efficiency and service levels of the two intersections proposed. Additional development controls have been proposed to encourage a greater proportion of yard-based activity within the zone and hence a reduction in traffic generation. This control primarily takes the form of a greater restriction on site coverage over the developable areas of the zone. With activity area 1A, site coverage is specified at 30%. Between 30 and 40% requires restrictive discretionary consent beyond that non-compliant. Activity area 2A, site coverage is set at 35%. Between 35 and 65% requires a restrictive discretionary consent, and beyond that, non-compliant consent is required. Modelling work undertaken by Mr. Bartlett is based on a comparison of traffic generating activities within the Glenda Drive industrial area. Based on the zone controls and modelling, Mr. Bartlett is satisfied that the two intersections will work efficiently and have acceptable service. Next, I'll just talk about whether that removal is within scope and permissible amendments, because I'm aware that the Count South or Jack's Point Residents Association and Jack's Point entity have raised this issue with the panel.
I've attempted to extend their further submission, but I've refused to accept that.
I've read your memoranda on that, sir, and I have read the submissions that Ms. Goward Baker presented.
Yes, you seem to ignore my memoranda.
Yes.
And I reminded her of it when she presented them.
I've got a bit to say about that myself, but anyway, I thought I would cover it off, because notwithstanding that it is a legal issue that's been raised as to whether there's scope, so I need to address it with you. Our relevant case law on scope has been referred to in legal submissions by counsel for the council in the opening stages of the review hearings. I don't take issue with those submissions as an accurate statement of the law on scope. In this case, the permissible extent of amendments lies somewhere between what was notified, a rural zoning with little in the way of development rights, and a fully functioning industrial zone as sought by the submitter. The number and design of accesses onto the state highway is a direct result of the extent of development that can be undertaken in the zone. As discussed above, the submitter has pared back the development by reducing the as-of-right site coverage by quite some margin from that notified. And I've noted there it's 10% in Activity Area 1A and 25% in Activity Area 2A. In turn, this has negated the need for a roundabout to service the traffic generation needs of the zone. It is not necessary that the removal of the roundabout arise as a result of a submission or further submission seeking the same. It's open to the submitter within the broad extent of the ambit of its submission to propose a reduction in the extent of zoning and or development control sought. In this case, the amended relief does not go beyond, but is within the extent of the package of development rights sought in the submission. Furthermore, it's Mr. Bartlett's evidence that there will be no greater adverse effects to the roading environment as a result of the removal of the roundabout than compared to that proposed in the submission. In particular, effects on the functioning of other intersections such as Woolshed Road will not be any greater than proposed in the submission. just turning now to the matter that you just raised, and whether the Jack's Point entities can extend their further submission. Clause 8, Schedule 1 provides that certain persons may make further submissions regarding further submitted Jack's Point entities. They do not claim to represent a relevant aspect of the public interest, but rather a person who has an interest in the submission greater than the public in general. While the rezoning of the land from rural to industrial and associated landscape and visual amenity effects, and potentially those of a reverse sensitivity nature, and I've noted there they've not presented evidence in respect of any of those, arguably gives rise to a greater interest, the issue of concern now raised being the removal of the roundabout at or near Walshead Road is too removed to give rise to a greater interest than the public in general. The submission proposed a staged highway access rule culminating in the construction of a roundabout in the vicinity of Walshead Road as the zone was developed to its fullest extent. Provision for a roundabout in the vicinity of Walshead Road under that fuller development scenario may have met the threshold in clause 8.1b, the roundabout being proximate to the Jack's Point related entities' land interests, although it's not a matter specifically referred to in their further submission. If one were to adopt the overall tenor of that further submission, the roundabout in this location triggered by development at the upper percentage of the Coneburn Zone's development yield could be a matter within the ambit of the further submissions in opposition. It's therefore curious and perhaps somewhat disingenuous that the further submitters now mount an argument that they are affected because the roundabout is not being provided. The submitter has reduced its development capacity yield, thereby reducing the volume of traffic generated. There's no need for a roundabout. The further submitters oppose the zone and the development that goes with it, yet cry foul at the removal of the roundabout. Allowing the further submitters to extend the ambit of their further submissions to now object to the removal of the roundabout is both beyond the jurisdiction of the relief sought in their further submission and an abusive process in my submission. I just want now to turn to an issue regarding the further submissions and non-service of them on the submitter. And I appreciate that this may well be something you want to hear from them about. And this relates to the two Jack's Point further submissions. They were never served on the submitter. My office was the address for service and I never received them. I've attached to my submissions copies of, it's actually just labelled, sorry, A, B and C, copies of email correspondence starting with attachment A to Ms Hill, copied to Ms Galloway Baker. Noting that I contacted both further submitters at their address for service, hadn't received a response and hadn't been served, and could she assist? I received no response whatsoever to that email. That was the 10th of July. Attachment B is a copy of email correspondence to Mike Coburn, who submitted or lodged the further submission on behalf of the Residents and Owners Association. Two follow-ups there, never heard further from him. Likewise, Mr. Ferguson, who lodged the further submission on behalf of the Jack's Point entities, again asked him for proof of service, followed it up, and I never had a response.
Just on that, I take on A, where you do have a response from Anderson Lloyd.
Oh, sorry,
that
A.
That was the amendment that was attached, was it, rather than the original further submission?
Yes, sorry, this was Ms Hill who had sent me a copy of the memorandum and the request to.
Yes.
Yes, that's right, and I followed that up by saying that I'd previously asked for confirmation of service from further submitters, hadn't heard, and could she assist?
Right.
So, Clause A first schedule requires service on other submitters. Clause 8A1B, a person who makes a further submission must serve a copy of it on the person who made the submission, to which the further submission relates. Compulsory requirement thereof must. And I say there must be consequences for non-compliance. And I refer then to Section 41C the ability to strike out on grounds of abusive process. Section 41C, directions and requests before or at hearings. I've set out the section there. You can strike out a submission if you consider that it would otherwise be an abuse of the hearing process to allow the whole submission or part to be taken further. Section 41C is contained in that part of the Act prescribing powers and duties in relation to hearings. There's nothing in sections 39 to 42 to suggest those powers don't apply to hearings in relation to a proposed district plan. To the contrary, section 39(1)(a) lists hearings in relation to a proposed plan as a type of hearing within the ambit of section 39. Turning to the elements of section 41C, before or at a hearing, this request to strike out is made at a hearing, this element satisfied, would otherwise be an abuse of the hearing process. The further submissions were never served. This is contrary to the Act's requirements. There must be consequences. There has been no application for a waiver. So I've put the further submitters specifically on notice that I haven't received their further submission. I've asked for proof of service. I've had no response and they've not sought a waiver. The language of the Act is mandatory. The further submission must be served. Service hasn't been effected. In my submission, there's no jurisdiction to accept and consider the further submissions absent service and proof of that on the submitter. Failure to serve provides grounds for strikeout under section 41C. And particularly, I say, in these circumstances where I have put the further submitter on notice that I haven't received their submission and I've received absolutely no feedback or correspondence in return. Failure to serve means there's no jurisdiction, I say, for the panel to consider the matters raised in the further submissions. Service is an essential component of natural justice. A person or entity cannot respond to another person's complaint or issue unless he or she has notice of it. The first the submitter knew of the further submission was the section 42A report. While indirect notice of the further submission, this is no substitute for the service requirements under the Act. While prejudice would normally be a consideration so far as late notice of further submissions is concerned, that's not relevant here because the further submitters have not sought a waiver of time to serve the further submission.
Can I interrupt you? Clearly, your client was aware of the further submission, wasn't he?
Once we received the Section 42A report, yes, not beforehand.
Right.
Because the way that the...
As the original hearing was originally scheduled, you were first up, weren't you?
Yes, we were, yes.
So there wasn't a great deal of time. I mean, if we're looking at it from the point of view of now, being here today, there's been a couple of months, probably 3 months, and plenty of time to respond to it. But, yeah.
Well, yes, I mean, at the end of the day, it's what I'm raising here is a process issue. And, yes. I mean, it's accepted that the further submitters haven't filed any evidence to support their further submission. So there really hasn't been anything for the submitter to respond to in that respect. It was, I mean, issues in relation to landscape, reverse sensitivity and all those types of matters that are raised by the further submitter's submission were being covered effectively in our evidence. So in that respect, there aren't any new matters or there's no new matters that have taken us by surprise. But it's simply the fact that they have not complied with the requirements of the Act. And as I say...
So I'm going... A strikeout is a discretion matter.
Yes, it is.
On yours.
That's similar to a chairman of this case.
Yeah, I know. So it's not... It's going a bit far to say there's no jurisdiction.
Yes, you're probably right there. It's not an absolute, yes. It is a discretion, yes, as to whether or not the strikeout is exercised.
Thanks.
Do you want to ask me questions about that now? So we're on this topic, do you want to wait till I finish?
No, I think I understand your point and your request, and I'll deal with that. separately, and probably, I'm presuming we'll finish today.
Yes, that's probably quite likely, mm-hmm. I expect, yes.
So I would deal with that this week, basically.
Okay, right, mm-hmm. Thank you.
To be fair, I think you're right. I think I do have to give the Jack's Point entities the opportunity
yes.
to comment.
Yes. Yes, it may well be, despite my requests, that they do have evidence of service.
They'll give to me because...
Well, in hopes they might take more notice of you than me, but then that remains to be seen. Just now turning to issues that remain outstanding. First of all, adequacy of hazard assessment and its timing. Mr. Buxton is uncomfortable that the hazard assessment lacks sufficient detail to support a rezoning submission of this nature. This matter is addressed by Ms. Hutton in her summary statement for the hearing. It also transpires that an earlier resource consent granted for a residential development over a large part of the quarry site was supported by a detailed hazard assessment completed by Tonkin and Taylor in response to a submission from the Otago Regional Council to that earlier notified application. That assessment investigated landslide movement, rockfalls and liquefaction, stability of cut and fill within the quarry site, and flooding from Stony Creek. The report concluded that the hazard mitigation measures were feasible and did not prevent development. That consent is the one that's referred to as the OASIS, and it was referred to in the Section 32A, or the consent was referred to in the Section 32 report that accompanied the submission, but the geotechnical report wasn't included with that information. The position for the submitter is that there is sufficient information available to support the rezoning, and it's appropriate to leave further detailed site investigation until a later consenting stage. Visibility effects and methodology to address height. There remains a difference of opinion between Dr. Reid and Ms. Snodgrass, particularly concerning visibility of development from the wider areas outside of the site. The evidence speaks for itself, and I submit the evidence of Ms. Snodgrass is to be preferred. She undertakes an analysis that's more grounded in my submission and in-depth than that of Dr. Reid. Mr. Buxton, to a lesser extent, Dr. Reid, expressed some unease with the height limit control and height structure plan. This is perhaps as a result of not understanding the methodology behind the workings of the rule. A methodology statement has been prepared by Mr. Hanson, the surveyor responsible for undertaking the visibility modelling work and inputting the information. This will be introduced by Ms. Hutton in her summary statement. She and Ms. Snodgrass are familiar with the methodology, however, if the panel has any technical questions, Mr. Hanson could attend the hearing to answer those or provide a response to them in writing. Transport. Further information and assessment is provided in Mr. Bartlett's summary statement, particularly regarding the use of the two access points onto the state highway in preference to the roundabout option, and modelling work that's been undertaken based on the comparable Glenda Drive traffic generating activities. The further assessment undertaken by Mr. Bartlett proves that the proposed accessway intersections will work efficiently and will have an acceptable level of service. Industrial retailing. As mentioned earlier, trade supplier is defined, is listed as a permitted activity in zone provisions. In his rebuttal, Mr. Buxton remains concerned that industrial zone provisions do not address pressure on industrial and yard-based activities to move out from industrial zones. Mr. Buxton goes on to express concern regarding the ability of trade suppliers to locate within the zone. I simply observe that neither Mr. Copeland nor Mr. Osborne express any concerns with trade suppliers locating in the proposed zone or that their location there is inappropriate. Food and beverage outlets will be addressed by Mr. Copeland and Ms. Hutton. Indigenous plants and or forests. There's one outstanding matter of disagreement between the ecologists, and that relates to whether one particular area where there is existing grey shrubland, whether the requirement should be to restore ecologically appropriate indigenous plant species or the more specific native forest. Mr. Davis prefers the former, as do I. My reasons are perhaps more pragmatic in that plant species includes all manner of species, including forest. The option therefore remains open to choose any mix of ecologically appropriate indigenous plants. In the face of uncertainty or disagreement between the experts, I say a more flexible approach is desirable. And then I've just set out there the submitters that can be called and the order. Happy to answer any questions the commissioners may have of me and my submissions. Right, thank you very much. So first of all, Ms. Snodgrass is going to present her summary statement addressing lands and land matters, and she's
I'd just like to note, please, that where I have written a yard at industry based zone, the name is obviously now the Turnburn Industrial Zone. Okay, so my name is Michelle K. Snodgrass. I filed a statement of evidence for the applicant dated 9th of June 2017. The following is a summary of the proposed rezoning from rural general to a Turnburn Industrial Zone, and is my response to Dr. Reed's rebuttal evidence dated 7th July 2017. The landscape context of the site of the Turnburn Valley includes a rural lifestyle type development at the base of the remarkable ski field access road, Jack's Point Resort Zone, Lakeside Estates, remarkable station and pastoral farming areas. Kingston Road, which is State Highway 6, runs north-south through the valley on the eastern side towards the toe of the Remarkables mountain range. The rural character of the immediate area is already significantly influenced by the Jack's Point Resort Zone. The rural character of the vicinity of the site is evolving into a peri-urban landscape character. The proposed Turnburn Zone, industrial zone, is located within a complex landform of hummocks, rolling slopes, gullies and a terrace. This landform is overlaid with exotic and native vegetation and naturally managed patterns, and is modified by existing land uses of quarrying, contracting yards, aquarias, forestry and pastoral grazing. The area is modified by the described land uses, has a low density industrial character, while the areas outside of the land uses have a natural and pastoral character. The proposed Turnburn Zone is comprised of activity areas and open space areas. The activity areas are generally located within the existing areas of industrial character where the landscape has been degraded and substantially modified topographically and have a minor level of visibility from State Highway 6. The open space areas include the areas of natural and pastoral character which also assist in screening the interior of the site from outside views. The landscape effects of the proposed Coneburn industrial zone will be to bring about an urban area into a central, less sensitive part of the site with the protection of natural land forms and vegetation on the more sensitive parts of the site around the exterior of the activity areas. The proposed zone will generally appear to be a continuation of the broader RLC character as viewed from State Highway 6, with a nil to medium level of visible development and an enhanced natural character. At a broader scale, the proposed Coneburn industrial zone will create an industrial development in proximity to the Jacks Point resort zone, lakeside estates and rural lifestyle development, wholly contained by a larger rural zone with a dominant and large-scale natural and pastoral character. The urban landscape character of the proposed activity areas is unlikely to spread beyond the activity areas into the broader RLC, while the proposed open space areas will potentially provide an enhanced quality to the RLC. Viewpoints from which potential views of the proposed zone change will be seen when travelling north on Kingston Road have been provided by a visibility mapping software which assesses the visibility of the site after development and without the benefit of existing and proposed vegetation. The mapping has been undertaken by Clark Fortune MacDonald. All other potential visibility has been assessed from site visits. Users and occupiers of Kingston Road travelling north. A part of the proposed zone change in future buildings within Activity Area 2A within the Trojan site and the current Wilson's Yard site will be visible. The visibility of the aforementioned part of Activity Area 2A could be mitigated by extending the open space area and future planting along the State Highway 6 frontage to the northernmost entrance road. This is approximately the area that's the entrance road into Wilson's contracting yard. Views to the above areas also be gained through two access roads orientated north-south on the northern boundary of the current Scope Resources Quarry site, where they cut through an existing man-made mound, which is part of the open space area. The visibility of buildings from the road cuttings would be minimised by restoration of the grey shrubland areas as detailed in the ecological management plan required under proposed performance standards 11.5.6. The remainder of the future buildings within the proposed zone change will be screened by topography within the site and surrounding landscape. The visibility of the activity area site will be medium and the visual amenity effect will be moderate and has the potential to reduce to slight with appropriate native mitigation planting. Users and occupiers of Kingston Road travelling south. When travelling south, views of future buildings and development from approximately Peninsula Road to the entrance of the current beef contracting yard are likely to be screened by future vegetation within Stony Creek, which is to be protected as an open space area. Existing topography between the viewer and the development area and the consented earthworks to lower the development area will screen remaining development. From the entrance to the Beaver contracting site until the entrance to the Wilson's contracting site, the development area will continue to be screened as a result of the provisions to replace wilded species with the open space area with native species to continue to provide mitigation of views. Once at the entrance to Wilson's contracting, views will be obtained for a short distance into the current contracting site, which is proposed to be Activity Area 2A. As described above, visibility from this viewpoint could be mitigated by extending the open space area along the Kingston Road frontage at the entrance to the Wilson's contracting site. From this point onwards south, the activity areas will be screened by the topography of the existing Western Hummock faces, which are to be protected as open space areas, and by the consented earthworks of RM669/00 to lower the development area face level. The degree of visibility of activity areas once planted in the open space areas described above has established will be low to nil. The effect on the visual amenity will be slight and has the potential to be reduced to negligible by extension of the open space area along the Kingston Road frontage of the Wilson's contracting site. Users and occupiers of Remarkable Ski Field Access Road. At Windy Point, views are likely to be gained into the proposed activity areas within the existing Scope Resources Limited Quarry and on the Trojan Holding site. This will be at a distance of approximately 2.3 kilometres. The remainder of the activity areas will be screened by the existing escarpment on the southern side of Stony Creek and future native vegetation within the Stony Creek open space area, and dense evergreen and deciduous vegetation between the lower sections of the ski field road and the activity areas. The zone activity areas will continue to be screened by existing topography and vegetation between the viewer and the study area. The degree of visibility will be low to moderate, and the effect on visual amenity will be slight to moderate, with the moderate effect occurring at Windy Point. Users and occupiers of Marina Heights. Views from Cresta Lane and No Exit Street in the Marina Heights subdivision are likely to be gained from small areas of activity areas within the southern part of the Trojan Holding site and the western end of the Beaver Contracting site. Stony Creek screens the remainder of views into the northern part of the proposed activity areas. Topography and vegetation outside of the site will continue to screen activity areas. At the viewing distance of greater than 5 kilometres and with the use of recessive colours, it is likely that the activity areas may be missed by a casual observer. The view will remain complex and detailed, with Remarkables and Frankton Arm dominating the view. The degree of visibility will be low and the effect on visual amenity will be slight. Users of Remarkables Park. Stony Creek, which is an open space area, will continue to screen views into the site once future native vegetation is established. Views of the activity areas within the Trojan land are likely to be minimal. The degree of visibility will be low and the effect on visual amenity will be negligible to slight. Users and occupiers of Frankton Township, south of Remarkables Park. The activity areas within the existing resources quarry are likely to be partially visible from north-south oriented roads within Frankton Township. It is likely, due to the proposed earthworks under RM669/00, that very small areas of the tops of buildings may be visible. The remainder of the activity areas will be screened by the protected open space areas and existing topography between the viewer and the study area. The degree of visibility will be nil to low and the effect on visual amenity will be negligible to slight. I have read Dr. Reed's rebuttal evidence and my responses are as follows. In paragraph 8.5, Dr. Reed agrees that buildings within the zone would not be prominent in views from State Highway 6, but only in close proximity to the site. She also agrees that buildings within the zone would be visible from a wider catchment. As I have described above in the summary, the degree of visibility of buildings within the proposed zone from the wider catchment, the Remarkables Ski Field Access Road, Cresta Lane, Remarkables Park and Frankton Township south of Remarkables Park will be negligible to moderate and absorbed into the landform. I am of the opinion that buildings will not be prominent when viewed from the wider catchment. I agree with Dr. Reed that the increased excavation within the site would create a deeper pattern of light and shade and that the excavated faces could be difficult to revegetate, depending on the final grade of the faces and use of topsoil. I note that those areas that are proposed to be deeply excavated have been approved under RM669/00 and the effect is part of the permitted baseline. I agree that street lighting would make the area prominent at night. In my opinion, that prominence would be experienced from elevated viewpoints, namely the Remarkables Ski Field Access Road, Cresta Lane, Remarkables Park and Frankton Township south of Remarkables Park, and would be viewed with lighting at Jack's Point, Hanley Downs. From less elevated viewpoints, the glow of street lights would be likely to be of a low visibility due to the consented earthworks to lower the base building level and the requirement to comply with the southern light, the lighting strategy for the Queenstown Lakes District. In both cases, the effect will not be completely isolated as it will be experienced with the night lighting effect from the Jack's Point Resort Zone and lighting at Remarkables Park in the distance when travelling towards Queenstown. The current style of lighting at Jack's Point is sensitive and low level, minimising light spill. The proposed Coneburn Industrial Zone will be required to comply with the Southern Lights, a lighting strategy for the Queensland Lakes District, and associated standards which will result in the zone also being minimally lit at night. While night lighting will make the area more prominent at night, it will not be noticeably greater than that of the Jack's Point Resort Zone, and the overall effect will not detract from the broader night sky quality. I do not agree with Dr. Reed at paragraph 8.6 of her rebuttal evidence that the proposed zone will have an adverse effect on the character of the surrounding landscape, which is part of the foreground of the Remarkables and the visual amenity of views of the Remarkables. The zone is not viewed in isolation in the foreground of the Remarkables. It would be viewed with development at Jack's Point Resort Zone, which has already established a node of considerable residential development. I also note that from the intersection of Kingston Road and Woolshed Road travelling towards Queenstown, parts of Remarkables Park are visible, clearly indicating to an observer it is on the outskirts of a town of considerable size. The open space areas and controls to protect and improve the more sensitive parts of the site will retain the dominant visual amenity of the natural and pastoral character, landscape character of the foot of the Remarkables.
Just do, just start a discussion about the differences between you and Dr. Reed with respect to the more distant views.
Yes.
What methodology did Dr. Reed follow when she did her evaluation of those distant views?
I don't know what methodology she'd used. I assume she would have gone to all those places as well. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell from the resident side.
No.
Okay. So we don't need it. Can you... the differences... Have you had any discussions with her in the last couple of months in order to understand more closely what the differences are between you?
No, my only... I have had a brief discussion with her quite a while ago, and that maybe possibly, which I can understand Dr. Reed, where she's coming from, it's possibly because we're so used to always having height poles put up to be able to assess visibility, and because in this case we are relying on a computer-generated model of what the height will be, that it could be possibly she may be struggling to believe what the modelling says, which is understandable given it would be quite a major change from what you can see now in terms of topography to what the earthworks can see will allow.
Mm. Okay. If someone pick it up and I'll come back to that in a moment. Mm-hmm.
I'll put to understand the relationship between the height rule, which is based on a level,
yes,
rather than a height limit as you'd expect on flat land.
Yes.
That and the excavation. It's nothing that requires that excavation to be done.
Sorry,
there's nothing that requires those excavations to be done and completed to the extent consented, is there?
No, not as far as I know.
But would the effect of that be if they didn't do that, then they'd still be caught by the height limit? Is that how it works?
Yes.
So they'd be forced to have a lower building?
Yes.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. I thought that's what it was, but I thought it was.
It's probably works in reverse to how we'd normally do it, is you take a piece of flat land and then you set your high level off the flat land to make sure it's not visible.
Yeah.
This has been worked the reverse, where you set the height to make sure it's not visible and you work down to work out what the height of the building is.
That's why I've been careful to understand it.
Yeah.
It may not be novel, but it's new to me.
Just on the night lighting issue, you referred to the southern light strategy. Is it possible to get better light provision, in other words, a lower light which still satisfies that then just complying with that strategy? And I ask this because I see a number of recent subdivisions, there seems to be a variability of the amount of light produced. And clearly they all follow the southern lighting strategy because it's compulsory.
Yes, how they interpret it within that though. I would possibly have to ask an engineer about how low you could go that you would still meet the standards.
I just note that, for instance, there's a roundabout there where I live where you can't see the lights until you're right under them. And that is good lighting strategy, but then more recent ones in other parts of the district, you can see when you're coming up for some distance.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering whether reliance on the southern light strategy is not necessarily going to do what you think, or is it?
That we might possibly need additional
Is there a requirement for a maximum lux estate from the zone or something?
Yes, that probably could be. It's quite practical to apply something that's quite specific to the site to ensure that it is the absolute minimum that we can manage. I would assume that because it's not a residential area that possibly it could need less night lighting.
And generally in business areas, industrial areas, they like to have security lighting.
That probably could be, yes, an actual role specific to the lighting level.
Could you just remind me where Windy Point is?
She basically zigzagged her way up.
High on the steep hill there.
Yes.
Above the zigzag.
Yes, you sort of use above the zigzag.
Right.
Yeah.
So from that point, you're saying it's visible from up there. But what else would be visible from up there?
Oh, Jack's Point is visible, the lake, you can see all the way down the lake, you can see Peninsula Hill. Yeah. And to see it from that point of Jack's Point, you're not seeing it from the road, you have to get out of the car and walk to the end of where the area's sort of been kind of flattened and stand right on the edge of that lip to look out and see over it. You can see, yes, huge areas from up there.
Yeah. Thank you. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Now I'm going to call Mr. Roughton, who's here on behalf of Mr. Steele to address the three waters evidence. Unfortunately, Mr. Steele has had a personal issue that has arisen, so he can't be here today. But I've been playing tag in Mr. Roughton's office because I understand he was involved primarily in the early reports that accompanied the submission in the Section 32, but called Mr. Steele in to produce evidence because he was going to be on leave. So anyway, luckily for us, he has a very good working knowledge of the project. He's basically going to adopt Mr. Steele's evidence, and we haven't prepared a summary because the evidence was quite short and sweet anyway. I just wonder, I might just get Mr. Roughton just to briefly perhaps explain your previous involvement in the project, and then he can answer any questions that you may have of him.
Yes, certainly. Thank you for that. I guess I've worked in the region here since the early 80s, and I guess for my 40 years worked primarily in infrastructure, water, wastewater, stormwater, and so with that background I assisted in preparing the initial infrastructure options report. You'll appreciate from seeing the options report that it was sort of a multifaceted approach with a few different aspects, so there were a number of people involved in that, but I was sort of to some extent coordinating the preparation of the report. And so with that background, I'm happy to answer any questions. Essentially, we've identified that we believe that the infrastructure can be managed quite satisfactorily. But you may have some specific questions that you want to ask on that.
Well, I was quite overwhelmed by the background reports and stunned by the simplicity of the original, the final evidence.
I know. That's because we were thorough in the first place.
Yes. So, no, I have no questions. Mr. Glasner from the council has no concerns. And
No, I have no questions.
Right. Thank you very much for that. Now, Ms. Huttons has gone away to ring Mr. Davis. Mr. Copeland's plane arrives at 11:05. So I wonder whether...
Well, it probably would be sensible to maybe take an adjournment now for half an hour. And that would give you a chance to have all your witnesses here.
Thank you. That's much appreciated. Yes. I don't think there's any adverse weather conditions out there that should be preventing Mr. Cope from arriving on time, so...
Yes, so we'll do that.